Okay, this.
Would you rather sit over here?
Oh, no, this is very fine. I know this can be very boring. This is side two of tape number one, interview with Admiral William Kenner. We're at his home in Hamlet, North Carolina. And I forgot to say on the other side that I believe this is May the 7th, and it's the day before Mother's Day. And so I'll have to, it's now 2:15 in the afternoon, and this is side two. I was wanting to get back to high school. And you were going to the technical high school, which was a co-ed and vocational high school. Tape's been off for a while, and I'm just trying to recapitulate. Your grandmother Bricker was still living with you, and but during this time, you believe that Uncle Phil died. But at the high school, was co-educational, and you belonged to the cadet corps, and the cadet corps was a very highly respected group at that time. You were corporals in your junior year and lieutenants in your senior year, and so you were even highly respected members of the cadet corps. And we were talking about the development of the social anemones that young men have to develop during these high school and formative years, and you were talking about some of the social functions and dances that the cadet corps had.
Well, there was some class dances, and every company had at least one or two dances a year, which were attended by members of other companies. So that was about all the dances. Of course, my brother and I weren't social lions, so to speak. We were small, and we had our nose in our books most of the time. So our social life, with as far as girls went, was very, very limited. And also, the home rules were very strict as to our goings and comings at night. So it didn't make for any great dating possibilities. Wasn't, I guess we didn't really have much feminine company until after we left home and got into the academy. We didn't have too much then.
Did you think much about this at the time?
No, I don't recall letting it worry me. I mean,
he was a different 15, 16-year-old than I was.
Well, things have changed a good bit since those days,
well,
believe me.
We're not that far different, Dave.
Well, maybe not. Anyway, we were, I guess it was the home discipline. We just minded our duty, so to speak, at home. And it wasn't until our last year or two in high school that we had these dates of any sort.
Do you remember any specific time that you always had to be home by? Or was that?
In high school, well, like at his dance, we had to come home right after the dance. The dances generally lasted until about 11 o'clock. And there was no staying out all night in those days, believe me. And so, and I imagine that very few of boys and girls in those days did, as far as I know.
Did you? Well, then you and Frank weren't heavy. You didn't have any steady girlfriends or have any big romances or anything like that.
No, not in high school. No.
Okay. Now, your main extracurricular activity was the cadets, which is a curriculum in itself, actually, which helped you immensely later on when you went to the academy.
Sure did.
Now, as you went through high school, you say your grades were, if anything, a shade better than Frank's on the average.
As I remember, yes.
Okay. And both of you did quite well in your classes, did you? Would you say you were above average, both of you, all through your classes?
No, I'd say we were good average.
You were a good solid average.
Yeah. We didn't get all E's on the report card, neither did we get. We got a few Fs, though. No, I'd say we rode along. If you want to put it on a numerical scale, I think we were about in the 80s, average in the 80s.
Okay. Did you have any traumatic experiences? You mentioned Frank got an infection in his foot when you were going to take the Annapolis test. For the Naval Academy. Well, what kind of infection did you get? Step on a nail, toenail?
No, some, I don't know, it probably came from a cut or something, became infected. It was an infection. It was nothing serious, and just took time.
I'm going to shut this off. This train will do everything. The train's gone by now, and we just mentioned something. Your name is Helen?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry to be so informal, but...
Oh, of course.
William's wife, Helen, just mentioned that they were identical twins, and when she first met them, sometimes for a split second, she wouldn't be sure which one was which. How about your mother, while I'm on that for a minute, or your father? Did you ever able to fool them one iota?
Once in a while. But mother always had a solution to it. If she saw one of us down the street, one of them, couldn't tell which one it was, she called Frank and William. Then she generally got both of us. So she'd take whatever one she wanted.
From a distance, they were that close, even your mother couldn't tell.
When we were,
usually hard to fool a mother.
It was after Frank broke his nose in an accident with me.
Now, this high school days?
Yeah, this was in high school days. Yeah, it was in high school days.
How'd this come about?
Well, we were... I found out that by, you know, the old-fashioned keys that had the hole in the stem and fitted over a pin in the locks? Or you're too young for that. You're too young. But anyway, if you got one of those old keys and got the proper size nail to fit into that, we filed off the point of the nail so you had a flat surface and that would fit into the lock. I also found out by breaking off the head of one of these old fashioned kitchen matches in the key and then put the nail in and bang the key down the sidewalk, you'd get a nice little firecracker effect, you know. So Frank and I were up the alley behind the house playing with our little handmade firecrackers or firearms or what have you. Mother called us and we started down the alley and I was right in front of him. Well, I dropped my key or whatever it was I was holding. And so just, you know, dropped down to my knees to pick up the key. Frank was so close behind me that he just pivoted right over and face hit my head. And he did give it a bad break. My father was in bed with the flu, or called grip in those days, at the time. So when Frank came up with his busted nose, Pop, you know, didn't pay much attention to those things in those days, as long as you weren't dead. So Pop needed it back in place and did fairly well till later life. Still had to be operated on.
That's
but
the
it put a big bump on it.
On your nose?
No, Frank. On his.
On Frank's nose. When he went over you,
he really broke it.
And your dad, rather than taking the doctor, he just kind of put it all
got
back
up off his bed, a sick bed, and needed it back in place. And it did for a number of years till Frank had to have it straightened out a little later on in life. But you can see by our pictures, I don't know, I guess Betty showed you pictures of him, didn't you?
Yes, I have quite a few pictures of him. None of you, unfortunately.
Well, you can notice
the
difference.
I'll get some today, I hope.
But I cracked my nose one time and put a hump on it, and I'm trying to think when I did it. But anyway, we had, that was about the only serious, well, that wasn't even serious injury. That was just the run of the mill in those days. We had no serious injuries or anything.
Well, now Frank got infected. Frank busted his nose. You say later you busted your nose somehow. Was Frank a little more accident prone than you, or?
No, I wouldn't say so.
He just had bad luck a couple times.
He was following me too close. He just fell over me. That was that.
Well, let's see now. When you were younger, and during the time, did you have any special friends besides the two of you? Was it Bill? Did you call each other Frank and Bill?
As I recall, yes.
You called him Frank?
I called him Frank.
And he called you Bill. He called you Willie?
Well, that name Willie, I don't know where that came from. But when we got in the academy, we were the smallest there, obviously the smallest that had ever been there. And everybody else, every other cadet there was right large, right good size. And if they were short, they were real heavy. And if they were tall, why, they were skinny, but they were still big. So Frankie and I were the smaller. And they pinned the name Frankie and Willie on us there.
Frankie and Willie.
Yeah, and that stuck for quite a long while.
Was that in the Academy book?
In the Academy.
Okay, but in the book, did they call you Frankie and Willie? In the Academy book, they always give you a nickname.
Yearbook?
Yeah. You remember?
Yes, I think Wee Willie they used to call me. And I'll have to look and see. I think I don't remember Frank having any special name other than Frankie.
Okay. Well, now, how about when you were really young? Did you ever have any teddy bears or any special toys or any special place or any special things?
Oh, when we were little, I remember we had teddy bears. And,
were they identical?
Yes.
How could you tell them apart?
Well, we took care of that. I don't remember us having any. Oh, we had childish squabbles.
Well, of course you did.
And but I don't remember any of them being. I can't recall any particular.
When was Miss Williams your neighbor that had the club?
Oh yes, funny thing. I found a letter the other day. You know, when I was looking for that key to the clock, found a letter that she wrote to Frank and I when we got our appointments to the Academy. But this lady crosses, she was a maiden lady, and she'd been very well educated, and she traveled quite a bit. She'd been to Europe, even to California, Yosemite Park, back in those days. And there were five of us boys in the neighborhood. One, Clyde Melville, Bob Williams, George Webb, and Frank and I. We all lived on the same short block outside the soldiers' home there. And it was, in those days, it was quite a nice neighborhood. All modest income family. So she organized what she called the Fun and Profit Club to occupy our time, particularly in the summers when school was out. And she had a meeting once a week. And she had us review a book, you know, about our educational level, historical novel or a biography or something like that. And we usually have little refreshments at each meeting. And she carried that on for a couple of years. And it was quite a undertaking for her, and she was really interested in it, and it was very beneficial to us. She taught us a little about parliamentary law, made us conduct the meetings and things like that. And she then jazz was coming in. She guided us into, of course, when World War I, by the more martial music. She played French songs for us and French marching songs and things like that on her Victrola and the marches. Susan and whatnot.
Her name was Mrs. Williams?
Miss Williams.
Miss Williams.
Miss
Williams. You called her a maiden lady. I take it this is a lady who's never been married.
That's right. And
and who were the other two boys? They lived on the block, but there were no relation. None of you were any relation to her.
No. Well, Clyde Melville, last I heard of him, he's in Dallas, Texas. He's a radio station in the advertising business for radio stations. Bob Williams, retired, semi-retired in Washington.
Now, his name is Williams, but that's no...
No. Maybe, no relation that I think to Miss Williams. Bob lives in Washington now. George ended up very tragically. What nowadays would be schizophrenia. He died in St. Elizabeth Hospital in Washington, years ago. And Clyde, Rob, that's five, and then Frank and I.
Let me make sure I have the name of the club, the Fun and Profit?
The Fun and Profit Club. We were supposed to have fun, and we were supposed to learn something and profit thereby, you know.
One thing I want to ask you real quick, and then we'll go to the Academy. I'm trying to watch my time because I know I have to be out of your way here. Were you baptized?
Yeah, in the Baptist church.
Did anyone ever tell you under what circumstances you were baptized?
We were, according to the other children, Frank and I were quite late in joining the church. But my father had some ideas about that, which prompted his not going to church. The Baptists in those days, and some sects of them now, are still that way. Come on, Mac. The Baptists in those days were quite rigid. And looking back on it, I think that they applied a great deal of pressure to children growing up to join the church when really the children didn't fully realize the import of it and what they were doing. And my father was against the old hellfire evangelism that was so prevalent in Virginia in the countryside that he grew up under. So when the Sunday school teacher came around one evening, I guess we were about 14, and gave us the old pitch about joining the church. Father wasn't home, so Sunday school teacher, he had quite an hour or two there to get his pitch in. But then my father came home, and he didn't care for this man anyway. He thought he was a hypocrite in some way, and he was. And my father found out what he was doing and whatnot, and then he read him all plenty. Very short, and he said, when the boys are ready and understand what they're doing, they can join the church. Not until then. That finished it. So we were a couple of years until I guess we were about 17 before we decided we'd join the church, and we were then baptized into the church.
Were you baptized at a
pool immersion?
At a fountain, or were you baptized in a pool somewhere?
Every for immersion, yes. The Baptist Church had a pool there. You've probably seen them.
Is that in Washington?
That was in Washington, yeah. But after we were in the academy in those days, you had to go to church on Sunday. But after we got away, we sort of drifted away from the church. And it wasn't until I married Helen that got to going to the Episcopal Church, and I liked it, and I liked the service. And as I told my mother when I decided to join the Episcopal Church, I said, it's about time I think about casting an anchor to windward. I better join this church. I've been very satisfied with the deal.
All right, now, we're going to put you into the military academy now. Now, you said they wanted 100 cadets. Which is quite a bit. Now, was that because they were looking forward to the rum-running days, or...?
No. Let's go back to 1922. Of course, the Prohibition Act was in effect, but I don't think the real rum-running actually started until, possibly 1922, 23. And then the offshore boats. See, let me get one thing straight. The Coast Guard never enforced the Prohibition Act. We were enforcing a Customs Act of about 1790 and 99 around in there. The illegal importation of goods into the United States. That was the only act the Coast Guard was enforcing.
The old Revenue Service.
The old Revenue Service. A lot of people thought that we enforced the Prohibition Act. We did not. And very few were in sympathy with it. To most of us, we said the country's just not going to do it. They're not ready for it. But we did our duty to cut down I think fairly successfully, with as much success as possible, the importation of liquor from the overseas. But for every with a small amount we got, well, there was a tremendous amount still came in. You couldn't guard every inch of beach. So when the Coast Guard advertised for the 100 cadets, the academy then and the service was very small. I think there were about 3,000 officers and men in it, as I recall. And that was in 1922. It had its little academy, but they were only graduating as low as 3 or 4 officers a year. They had few applicants, and most of the cadets were either, I had heard of the academy through relatives who were officers of the old Coast Guard or the Revenue Marine or the Revenue Cutter Service, as it was up to 1915. And they were short officers. They were, in those days, you served 3 years as an ensign and then were promoted to JG. Well, they had few ensigns. So they decided they would take in a large class at the academy and would take in 100.
All right. Now, was this the famous class of 26?
25.
Well, I can't remember which class, but I think you were in the famous class.
Yeah, 25,
the class of 25.
Yeah, 25 was
the
famous
class.
Well,
there's two reasons for that being such a famous class. And one, it must have been one of the largest classes that they'd had in...
It was.
...decades.
It was. In fact, I think we started off, actually, they didn't get their 100. We started off with about... Geez, I wish I could remember. They took it in 2 sections. And, of course, we went in the first section, which entered in July, and then another part entered in September. But I think they had a total of the 2 sections about 70-some cadets. And the attrition was kind of high that year, so it went down the second year to about, I'd say 40. Actually, 21 of us graduated, and we were graduated early.
Of course, you did graduate early.
Yes.
Okay, now, we're skipping an awful lot. We've got to go back, but I've heard very much about this class. Out of this class, it was the most unusual class that ever graduated from the academy, because by the time they were finished, I believe over half of the class made admiral, which is absolutely unheard of in any military academy of any size, shape, form, or description.
Well,
and they almost could make a study on why this particular class turned out to be...
Well, there are a number of factors. One, you could almost say that we were at the right place at the right time. We came in 1922. Everybody got disturbed about rum row and the importation of foreign whiskeys, particularly the prohibitionists. So something had to be done. So Congress increased the Coast Guard, doubled it practically. They needed officers. Well, here we were sitting in the academy. So we made the last, our third year cruise. In those days, the academy course was 3 years. It wasn't changed until 3 or 4 years after we left the academy to a 4-year course. But the requirements to enter the academy on that 3-year course were much more stringent than later, because they broadened the course to 4 years. A lot of things we were required to know, like trigonometry and whatnot, was given in the first year in the academy in the 4-year course. We had to know it before we got there. Same as the old cadet engineers who had to be graduate engineers of an engineering school, and they only stayed 1 year, that was the old engineer corps. There's lots of old stories about that, and the animosity between the line and the engineers, which went on through the years till it was abolished, finally, the separation. But anyway, get back to the Coast Guard. So they decided we make our last cruise, our first class cruise, and then instead of granting us leave and instead of we helping outfit the ship for the cruise, we had to spend all our class and time in classes. and gave up our leave and everything and made our last cruise. And then when we came back from that, we spent another month or two in classes, and then we were graduated and immediately signed the ship. In the meantime, and then the old cutters were not fast enough. The rummies were not stoops. And they found out that the average speed of the rugged old cutter was about 12, 15. We even had some that went 15 knots, which was pretty speedy in those days. So they just stepped their vessels up to 16, fuel advantages and whatnot. 16 was enough. So then they, as I understand it, now this is rumor, not fact, but the Navy was approached about creating an offshore task force to combat this rum row. The Navy rightfully, said we have no part of that. We have no authority. There's no constitutional authority for us to, or precedent for us to even undertake such duties. And also, with the civilian population, like the military, enforcing civil law. Good point, even those days. The Coast Guard, that's their duty. They prevent the importation of illegal goods. Give it to them. But we had no ship. So they said, well, they can take these destroyers. So the Coast Guard acquired 20 destroyers of World War I vintage, the old four stackers. You don't remember them.
Yes,
you're too young.
Yes, I've actually done a World War Stacker. I was World War II. In the very first part of World War II, they...
Well, that's right, they were four stackers. But I'm talking about World War I four stackers. I'll show you a picture of one I served in. Well, I served in a couple of those. So they needed officers. So I think they gave us... Yeah, they gave us 3 weeks' leave, which really stretched the hearts in headquarters. But they decided we ought to have the leave. And that was the regulation, academy regulation, or the regulations of the service at the time, that upon graduation, the cadet got a month's leave. They gave us 3 weeks. And then we were assigned to the Philadelphia Navy Yard, where they were commissioning these 20 destroyers. And believe me, they were some ships. In the modern, today, you wouldn't set foot on one, it might fall apart. But they were been run to death during the war. The Navy, I understand, in Philadelphia said, well, the Coast Guard will operate them 1 year, and then they won't be fit to operate anymore. Well, the Coast Guard kept those things going until 1930, 33, 35.
Until the late class and later the secretary class cutters came in, you had to use them. There wasn't anything else to use, was there?
Well, of course, Prohibition died in 1933, as I recall. And then the Coast Guard gave up its destroyers. Meantime, some newer cutters had been built. The Lake Class came in, which were nice ships for their size. The Secretary Class was built in 1937. I served in the Ingham on her, in that class. No, I was, yes, that's the Ingham went to Puget Sound, Port Angeles, yes. But before that, I got one of the ships, the 165-footers, built on the West Coast in the Seattle, what the hell was that shipyard there? Anyway, I took the first ship of the 165s out of Seattle. See, they built those in two increments, 9 on the East Coast and 9 on the West Coast.
Okay, I'm going to back you up now, back to the Academy again.
Yeah.
Okay, now you and Frank were going together. That was, you know, it's kind of nice having, you know, when a fellow goes to the Academy, you know, he's uprooted from his home and family, and it's pretty traumatic. Plus, he gets thrown into this military discipline, and unless he had had discipline at home or belonged to the cadets like you did, you know, it's a shock. Thank you. It's an awful shock to a fellow. But here, you could take your twin brother with you, so to speak. You and Frank were together. You could lean on each other a little bit. You were used to discipline in the home. Plus, you'd been in cadets and were used to military-style discipline to some limited extent in cadets. So I imagine you were just about twice as well off as the average guy showing up there at the Academy. Now, where was the Academy located then?
That was New London, Connecticut, in the old Fort Trumbull.
Old Fort Trumbull. And how did you get from Washington, D.C. to Fort Trumbull?
By train, the Federal Express. Okay. Boston to Washington.
And you and Frank, though, went together.
Yeah, we went together. And funny thing, we never roomed together at the Academy.
Did the Academy specifically split you up? Probably.
Well, no, our seniority was established by the list that headquarters had according to our standing on the examination.
He was four and
so
you were
there were two cadets to a room, so therefore number one, top man, number one and two went to one room, three, four went to the other, five, six went the other, somehow or the other.
They did that though, huh? They put the two top men together. Yeah. Rather than the top man and the bottom man. Or
yeah.
Anything like
well, that late came later. That
oh, that's very nice, Helen. Thank you.
That wow. Break came due to our class too. So getting back to our class, as I say, it was almost we were at the right time at the right place. And
okay, there. Now you and Frank arrived at the Academy, and were well prepared for the Academy life.
Well, I think so, and as far as studies went, I think the education we got at McKinley prepared us pretty well to undertake first year. I don't recall having any great difficulty.
But the attrition rate was pretty high.
Well, yes, it was. But it was at, 40%.
First year?
Oh, I guess first year would be about 40%. But we had no, I don't recall either of us having any great.
Okay, now how about sports?
Well, we were still the smallest. We were smaller, so.
But could you get in the gymnastics or tumbling?
Oh, yes. They had a program of athletics there. We had to participate in inter-class games, but somehow my brother and I always got paired off in the, let's say, the shorter one. And there was a lot of physical drill. And, of course, the athletics at the Academy and the physical training program then was patterned somewhat after that book put out by the Naval Academy that, you know, races all sports and all that. Well, they used that as a pattern. Before that, there had been no serious physical training course at the Academy. And, well, there were too few cadets. So when our class came along, they had to do something with
something. Didn't have an intramural football team when there was only 30 guys in the whole school.
No. And also there was a great deal of boat drill. And
how about rowing?
Oh, God. We rowed our lives away up there. Well, from the cruise time the ship got back, when the winter term started, every morning, the morning exercise was rowing across the Thames River and back in the old surf boat, weighed about 1,600 to 1,800 pounds.
What, about 10 oars?
Sometimes 10, generally 8.
And did you have a coxswain?
Yes, the coxswain, senior cadet.
Senior cadet, not you and Frank.
Well,
later on. Huh?
There were only so many boats, so many coxswains, and the rest of the cadets rowed.
Now, Frank ended up to be well known for his ability as a coxswain, at least as a surf boat.
Yeah. Well, we all had that training. But as the upperclassmen were the coxswain and the lowerclassmen.
And every morning you wrote that?
Every morning till Christmas leave. And then it would be so damn bitter cold on that Thames River. New London, those days were cold in winter, you know, New England winter. And we up to Christmas then. We took the boats out of the water and put them on the dock, and then we could go on Christmas leave. And first, what they thought might be a spring day, actually, spring up there would be winter the rest of the country. We put the boats back in the water and then started the rowing till the cadet cruise. That was in May, June 1st, generally.
Okay, now the first year, you guys able to keep your nose pretty clean?
Yes. We only got out, you know. You didn't get much liberty. You got out Saturday afternoon till midnight on Saturday, and you got out Sunday from church, so you had to go to church about 10 o'clock until 10 o'clock at night. And that's all the liberty you got. That depended on your conduct grade. If you got more than 10 merits the previous month, you were on second conduct, which cut your liberty in half for the following month. If you were on third conduct grade, you got 4 Saturday afternoons a month, and that's all you saw outside the brick wall. And the academy, I've got a picture of the old academy in there. In fact, I've got that album I can get very readily and show you old Fort Trumbull and what life was there, pictures, cadets and everything. But the present academy was not built until in the 30s.
Okay, now in your first year, were either you or Frank having any deportment problems with your demerits?
Well, no serious deportment problems. Errors and sins of commission and omission. But, like uniform or a little dust found in your room and things like that. It wasn't hard to amass some demerits. And, of course, the first class one rode herd on you. They were the senior men, third-year men.
Trying to get even for their first year, right?
Well, they were bringing us up. Like, one time I got 10 demerits for thinking. Because we had a character who we called Chiefy. But he actually had a profile like the head on a buffalo, Indian head on a buffalo nickel. Mm-hmm. You remember?
Yeah.
Well, we called him Chiefy. And I was section leader one day, and we had a class at the down by the sail loft, and there were 3 or 4 sections there, and I thought I heard him say sections dismissed, move out. So I promptly marched my section off to the next class. So Chiefy got me, and he said, "What the hell do you think you're doing?" I said, "I thought I was." He said, "Oh, you're not paid to think. I'll think for you. 10 demerits." Well, of course, that shot next month's liberty, cut it in half right then and there. But little things like that. But there were no serious offenses. We didn't jump the fence or anything like
that.
Can
you think of any time that, did Frank have a propensity to get
not till his last year. Then he unfortunately got enamored, or the girl got enamored with him. You're not going to put this in any story now.
Only if it's true. Go ahead.
Oh, well, this is just a rumor. Unsubstantiated.
But
they got interested, and Frank was dumb for getting himself entangled, but she was a damn nice girl. But also, first classman had been dating her pretty steadily and been feeding her, too. That was the main thing, the college girls up there. They were hungry as lot you ever saw. So Frank had a date with Marge and took her to the famous O'Leary's restaurant there, which had the best food in New London, not the best reputation, because the theatrical people from the old vaudeville days inhabited the O'Leary Hotel and ate in the restaurant, so it was frowned on by the college for the girls. But anyway, Frank took Marge there, and there was the first classman. That fixed him. So the motto was, as far as first classman was, don't care which Kenner, it's a Kenner, he gets spotted. So Frank really hovered on third conduct for most of the year, and sometimes he was perilously close to the limit when he'd get before the board. So I would go up and tell the first classman he made a mistake, it was me that was late or something the other, and so I would...
Did you take the rap for the date with Marge?
Well, not directly. I took it indirectly, you mean?
In other words, he got the date and you got the demerits.
Well, ultimately, he got up to a certain point where he couldn't stand anymore, and then I took a few of them for him to keep him in. But
getting into the fourth and up before the
later on, you know, the first class was involved. He was commissioned, of course, and graduated and whatnot. We became the best of friends in later life. And
well, now he just accidentally ran into him. Well, why was it demerits for him to be there? Was it after hours, during the week, was it?
No, that was all perfectly legal. But this guy got him, in the course of the inside the academy, you know, for Room inspection. You can always find something wrong with
I
the
see.
Room.
In other words,
it's just an accumulation of small demerits. But
why was the date with Marge made the upper class than that? Because he'd been dating her? Was that?
Yeah, he'd been feeding her, and he'll have an underclassman move in on him like that. Well, that was unthought of.
That
was disrespectful.
Why, of course. I understand that right away.
But that was good, something good to laugh about.
So, actually, demerits were manageable as long as they didn't get out of hand. In other words, they didn't go on your permanent service record or anything like that.
No,
they
didn't
affect your academy grades.
Unless you went
to the board.
When they averaged you, your standing for the next year was based on your performance in, say, an academic year, and also the cadet crews. And your demerits figured, in fact, I might have lost a couple of numbers on demerits, but it was so small it didn't.
You mean your class standing?
Yeah.
Final class standing.
Final class standing.
So they did have some effect.
A little.
So Frank might have cost you a couple of standings.
Well, I always thought I told him I'd have been senior to him.
Might you might have helped his class.
You
would
have been pretty damn demerits.
Beautiful.
But actually,
what did Frank say to all that?
Oh, it was good, clean fun. And,
okay, I can understand.
And he'll say later on why we were the best of friends.
The upperclassmen who got on to Frank over Marge, what was his name? Anyway, you said you later became great friends.
His name was Marin.
Marin?
Marin. But don't quote it.
M-A-R-I-N.
M-A-R-R-O-N.
That's almost like my middle name, Marion. Marin. M-A-R-R-O-N. Don't quote it?
Don't quote it, no, because he married the daughter of Assistant Secretary of the Treasury later in life.
Gibbons?
No. Who was, before that?
Before Gibbons? I'm not that good a historian.
It must have been in the early 30s, because this man had the secretary or assistant secretary.
The secretary was Morgenthau all during the Roosevelt administration.
Then it was the assistant secretary.
Gibbons was the assistant.
Yeah, I know about Gibbons. This is before that.
Gibbons. No, I don't know his name.
No.
The only reason I know Gibbons is because he was assistant secretary.
Yeah, well, we know him too. We didn't love him by any manner of means. He was an oddball.
Who was commandant at that time?
Now, that's a good question.
Well, it's about a record.
Now, wait a minute. Was she? Hamlet, I guess, was commandant during Hamlet.
Isn't that unusual? We're here in Hamlet?
Harry Hamlet. See, was she, the father of the young man you interviewed, or just saw out in St. Louis. He's living.
Kansas City.
Where?
Kansas City.
He's down in Kansas City now. His father was...
Came in 36.
Yes, and I'm trying to think back. Oh, Ballard. Ballard was the commandant at the time we graduated from the academy and until, about 1930. Then came Hamlet. Then came Wasey. And he was the wartime commandant.
Wasey went right on through till he died.
Yeah, he was a grand man, Wasey was. And his son was the one that was the watch officer when he grounded the Atascara on the islands and so forth.
I was surprised. He told all about it.
Yeah. I wish it never came out to the best of my knowledge, but I would have loved to have seen the letter.
I have the cruise reports and I have the letters of it. It's really funny.
No, I mean the letter his father wrote to his son.
Oh, I didn't
about that grounding.
No, he didn't say about it.
Well, I don't know who told me about it. I can't recall. But there was someone had seen the letter on the Itasca.
Well, I've seen the letter from the commanding officer about the problems involved.
No,
and I also saw the cruise report, which had to mention it, too.
But no, this was...
You know,
well, as I understand it, it was one of those mistakes that was very easily made.
You can't really blame the watch officer. He had night orders, and he did exactly what his night orders told him to do. The only thing, of course, you're always supposed to be alert. You're not supposed to run the ship up on the reef.
Well, I know, but Frank explained to me. Frank, in fact, at his home in Honolulu, had that light that was put on that island. He inherited that when he wouldn't let that go. He wasn't going to have it destroyed. The Warren boys got it and gave it to him, and he had it in his yard. And
he did?
That Diamond Head.
Or old, what do you call it, acetylene light?
Yes, and it was a little lighthouse, lens and everything. He had it in his yard there.
Well, I have to ask Betty about that. It might still be there.
Well, she sold it.